Chapter 18. Cataract clouds obscured the surface, a striated covering shot through with pyroclastic sparks and amber lightning. Nicaea was a new world, its geology unfinished and its final form not yet set. Tectonic movement and kilometers deep pressure waves rippled below the crust, sending shock waves through the mantle and ripping some continents apart while slamming others together. Two stormbirds and a stormhawk knifed through the clouds like swooping birds of prey, their crimson hulls painted with corrosive rain as they descended through the volatile atmosphere. Nicaea was a world in flux, its character in the throes of violent birth. Space around the planet was a choppy soup of electromagnetic static, the approaches lousy with spatial debris caught in the whirling, inconstant gravity waves that rendered geomagnetic guidance systems inoperative. Only by following a constant beacon of incandescent light that speared into the heavens from the world below could any craft hope to navigate the Nicaea system. To attempt to find Nicaea, let alone a fixed point on its surface, without the aid of this signal, would have been impossible for any but the luckiest pilots in the galaxy. It had taken an entire year for the 28th expedition to travel from Hexium Minora to this remote corner of the galaxy. Adamant sat up front in Scatter Prime, the consoles before the pilots alive with flickering lights, vector diagrams and tri-dimensional contour maps of the jagged terrain. Pulsing cables connected the pilots to the avionics package, allowing them to fly purely on instruments, which was just as well, as the juddering canopy of the cockpit was smeared with ash and smoke. Though the thought was faintly blasphemous, Adamant hoped the machine god was watching over them. To lose control above such a hostile world was as sure a death sentence as could be envisaged. Not that the pilots were actually guiding the Stormbird. That duty fell to Yeta Innovance, the navigator, strapped to the converted gravity harness where Adamant normally performed his close protection duties when flying into harm's way. Innovance had protested at being forced to leave his hermetic dome aboard the FOTEP, but had recanted his objections when told who he would be guiding and whose light he would be following. Magnus the Red sat behind the navigator, resplendent in a gloriously embroidered tunic of red and gold, shawled with a weave of golden mail hung with feathers and precious stones. In honour of the occasion, each of Magnus's forearms was sheathed in an eagle-stamped vambrace, and he wore an entwined lightning bolt girdle around his torso. His hair was loose, glossy and mirror-sheened, the colour of arterial blood. No finer warrior scholar existed in the galaxy. The slight form of Mahavastu Callimachus sat beside Magnus, the heavy robes he wore unable to mask his gaunt frame. Callimachus was venerable, as Lemuel had described, but Adamant had not realized how much the Primarch's control over him was costing the Remembrancer. A heavy satchel of blank books rested against the fuselage, fresh pages for the scrivener to fill with Magnus's words and deeds. Adamant caught the Primarch's eye. Today, an excited eclipse of pale blue and hazel flecks.
"We are close, Azik," said Magnus, "in every sense."
"Yes, my lord, we land in less than 10 minutes."
"So long, I could have guided us in half the time," cried Magnus, glaring at the recumbent form of the navigator. His anger was false, and he laughed.
Magnus slapped a luminescent hand upon the navigator's shoulder, causing him to flinch.
"Ah, don't mind me, Innovance," said Magnus. "I'm simply impatient to see my father once more. You are doing a grand job, my friend."
Adamant smiled. The melancholy that wreathed Magnus's soul after Ulanor had dispelled when word came of the conclave on Nicaea. The year spent traversing the Immaterium from Hexium Minora had seen a frenzy of research and study aboard the FOTEP as Magnus handed out theoretical proofs, philosophical arguments, and convoluted logic conundrums for his sons to solve in order to sharpen their minds. Nicaea promised to be the vindication of the Thousand Suns, and neither Magnus nor his legion would be found wanting. Adamant turned back to the cockpit. According to the unwinding telemetry, they were practically on top of their destination, but the cloud cover was still impenetrable.
"Taking us down," intoned the pilot. "Beginning approach. Ground landing protocols exchanged and verified. Tether signal accepted and control relinquished."
The pilot sat back as control of the aircraft was surrendered to Custodes ground controllers. The aircraft dipped its nose and went into a steep, looping descent. Adamant had a brief,
sinking sensation in his gut before his enhanced physiology compensated. The clouds streaked past the canopy, the glass slithered with moisture and streaks of grey, muddy ash. Then they were below it, and the landscape of Nicaea was laid out before them. It was black and geometric, a profusion of angular debris strewn upon the ground like the primordial shapes that lay at the heart of everything, and which had yet to be cloaked with the lie of individuality. Perfect spheres rose from the basalt ground, rippled with liquid lines of their formation. Vast cubes sat side by side upon steppe volcanic plains, arranged in convoluted patterns that seemed a little too random to be random at all. Magnus appeared at his side, like an excited probationer about to take the Lieber thrower and become a neophyte. The Primarch peered through the canopy and took in the geometric precision of the landscape.
"Incredible," he whispered. "The genesis of a world. The order of the universe described in mathematics. Perfect shapes and geometry. How like my father to choose this place. He knew it would speak to me. It is the shards of my youth on a planetary scale."
The Stormhawk dipped lower, banking its wings on its final approach, and a vast conical landmass slid into view. It was a gigantic stratovolcano, steep-sided and rugged with hardened lava, tephra, and blackened ash. It pierced the clouds, and Adaman knew with utter certainty that a great amphitheatre was carved within its heart. A column of purest light soared from the summit crater, invisible to mortal eyes, but a blazing spear piercing the heavens to those with ether sight. A gathering thundercloud, shot through with golden lightning, filled the sky above the volcano. Adaman had felt the light's presence as soon as the ships of the 28th Expedition had translated into the Nicaea system, but to actually see it ahead of him was like waking from a coma into a brightly lit room.
"Throne, it's glorious," said Magnus. "That is true power, a mind that can reach across the galaxy and bind an empire together in the dream of unity. It humbles me to know we serve so magnificent a master."
Adaman didn't answer. His mouth was dry, and his heart thundered in his chest. The light was magnificent. It was glorious and incredible in its potency and purity. Yet all he felt was a mounting sense of dismay. "I have seen this before," he said.
"When?"
"On Agoru," breathed Adaman. "When I swam the great ocean hunting the threads of the future. When I met Ota Weirdmake. I saw this. The volcano, the golden light."
"And yet you said nothing. Why did you keep it to yourself?" asked Magnus.
"It made no sense," said Adaman, unable to keep the dread from his voice. "The visions were fragmentary, disjointed. It was impossible to tell what it meant."
"No matter," said Magnus.
"No," said Adaman. "I believe it matters. I believe it matters very much." Landing lights winked in an ever-decreasing cruciform pattern as the custodian's remote pilots reeled the Stormhawk in. The other two craft remained in their holding pattern and would not descend until the first bird was clear. The Stormhawk slammed down in a hammer blow of burnt metal and gritty sulphurous backwash. As soon as it landed, a strip of white light extended onto the platform as a blast-shielded door lifted open. Elongated shadows stretched from the detachment of warriors in armor of blood-red and amethyst that marched from the side of the mountain. Massively wrought and precise, the honor guards of Astartes took up their position before the Stormhawk's assault ramp. Some carried gold-bladed rhomphire, while others drew enormous silver-bladed swords, which they reversed and set on the platform with their gauntlets resting on the pommels. The Stormhawk's ramp lowered with a whine of pneumatics, and Magnus, the Red, descended to the surface. Followed by Adaman and the shuffling form of Callimachus, the Primarch stepped from the ramp and took a deep breath of the hot, burnt air of Nicaea. Callimachus let out a soft gasp, and sweat gathered on Adaman's forehead, though he said nothing. A detachment of 9 segment warriors formed up behind Magnus, subtly matching themselves before the warriors on the platform. These were no ordinary Astartes. These were the elite of 2 legions. The sword-armed warriors were no less a force than the sanguinary host, the elite protectorate of the Lord of the Blood Angels. The Phoenix Guard of Lord Fulgrim stood with them. Their long-bladed rhomphire held ramrod straight at their sides, perfectly poised and immaculately presented. Their presence could mean only one thing. Two giant figures emerged from the volcano, walking side by side like old friends. Adamant's heartbeat spiked at the sight of them. The first a gloriously caparisoned warrior in armour of gold and purple, with flaring shoulder guards and a billowing cape of scarlet and gold. His hair was brilliant white, bound at his temples by a band of silver, and his face was one of perfect symmetry, like divinely proportioned Euclidean geometry. The second figure wore armour of deepest crimson, the colour vital and urgent. Wings of dappled black and white rustled at his back. The feathers hung with fine loops of silver wire and mother of pearl. Hair of deepest black framed a face that was pale and classically shaped, like one of the thousand of marble likenesses that garrisoned the imperial palace of terror. Yet this was no lifeless rendering of a long-dead luminary. This was a living, breathing angel made flesh, whose countenance was the most beauteous in existence.
"Lord Sanguinius," said Araman in wonder.
"And Brother Fulgrim," completed Magnus. "Thermitas, Utilitas, Venustas."
It seemed they heard him, for they smiled in genuine pleasure, though the words must surely have been lost in the feral growl of the Stormhawk's cooling engines. The Primarchs were illuminated in the reflected glow of the volcano, their smooth features open and welcoming. They wore the faces of eager siblings pleased to see their brother, though they had seen one another only recently at Ullinor. Magnus stepped towards Fulgrim, and the master of the Emperor's children opened his arms to receive his brother's embrace. They spoke words of greeting, but they were private, and Araman allowed himself to look away from the majesty of the Phoenician's countenance. Next, Magnus turned to Sanguinius, and the Primarch of the Blood Angels kissed his brother's cheeks, his greeting heartfelt but reserved. Only now did Araman notice the warriors accompanying each Primarch. Sanguinius had two attendants. One, a slender ascetic with a killer's eyes, and another with such pale skin that the veins of his face were clearly visible beneath. Araman took his place beside Magnus as he and Sanguinius parted. Magnus turned to him and said,
"Brother Sanguinius, allow me to introduce my chief librarian, Azek Araman."
The Lord of the Angels turned his attention upon him, and Araman felt the full force of his appraisal. Like Russ before him, Sanguinius evaluated Araman swiftly, but where Russ sought out weaknesses to exploit, Sanguinius looked for strength to harness.
"I have heard much of you, Azek Araman," said Sanguinius, his voice surprisingly gentle. For all its apparent softness, there was violent strength concealed within it, like a riptide beneath a placid seascape. "You are thought highly of by many beyond your legion." Araman smiled, pleased to hear such praise from the lips of a Primarch. "My lord," he said, "I serve the Emperor and my legion to the best of my ability." "And what abilities they are," said Sanguinius with a knowing smile. The Primarch turned to introduce the warriors at his side.
"Magnus, this is Raldoron, chapter master of my protectors," said Sanguinius, placing an elegantly sculpted hand on the shoulder of the warrior with the lethal eyes. Next, he turned his attention to the warrior with the pale skin.
"And this is Captain Thoros, one of our most vaunted captains of battle."
Both warriors gave deep bows, and Araman had a sudden flash within his mind, like a single, incongruous pick frame slipped within the passage of one moment to the next. A screaming, multi-limbed, arachnid beast, all fangs and blade limbs. So swift was it, Araman wasn't even sure he'd seen it, but it lingered like a harbinger when he looked at Thoros. He shook off the image as Fulgrim turned to his warriors. Both were proud and haughty with an air of casual superiority that immediately made Araman wary. As flawlessly presented as their Primarch, they were perfect in every way, but had none of the humility of Sanguinius's Praetorians.
"Magnus, allow me to present my lord commanders, Eidolon and Vespasian."
"A very real pleasure to meet you all," said Magnus, bowing to his brother Primarch's warriors, honouring them as he honoured their masters.
"Well," said Fulgrim, "this promises to be a momentous day, brother. So, shall we get on?"
"Of course," said Magnus. "I am eager to begin."
"As are we all," promised the Phoenician.
Sanguinius and Fulgrim led them into the heart of the volcano, the tunnels within glassy and smooth, indicating they had been formed with industrial-scale melters. They cut through the heart of the volcano,
wide enough for the three Primarchs to walk abreast, spiralling upwards through the solidified lava. The tunnels were lit with fiery luminescence, as though the molten heat of the magma at the volcano's heart was seeping up from below. Araman removed his helmet to better appreciate the startling geology of the volcano. Seeing shifting bands of crystalline layers through the translucent rock, like the sedimentary bands of an exposed rock face. "This world may be young, but this volcano is old," noted Araman, seeing the glances passing between Fulgrim's Lord Commanders as he spoke. He couldn't read their auras, and nor could he establish a link to his tutelary. The glare of the Emperor's light was too powerful, overshadowing everything with its intensity. Araman wondered if Magnus was similarly blinded by it. He watched Magnus and his brothers, as they spoke in low tones, relishing the sight of his Primarch in the company of peers who harboured no ill will towards him. Yet, despite the bonhomie, their discourse was superficial. The more Araman studied the ebb and flow of their conversation and body language, the more he saw the supple flex of linguistic sparring. The Primarch spoke of past campaigns, old glories and shared experiences, treading only on the comfortable ground of memory. Any hint that the subject of their meandering words might turn to matters of the future or the nature of the conclave was subtly deflected by Fulgrim, turned around and steered to safer ground. "He's hiding something," thought Araman, "something he doesn't want us to know about this gathering." Magnus must also be aware of it, but his Primarch gave no sign that he was anything other than a willing actor in this unfolding drama. Araman looked at the Emperor's children behind and before them, now seeing them as a prisoner escort instead of an honour guard. He wanted to warn Magnus, but nothing he might say could change their course. Whatever awaited them in the great amphitheatre he knew lay at the heart of this volcano, they had no choice but to face it. This was one destiny where the future was immutable and changeless. The coiling passage wound ever upwards, and Araman knew they were close to the summit. The glow of the walls grew brighter, and Araman saw the extra light was coming from a vaulted antechamber of mirror-smooth basalt and glass. Servitors awaited their arrival with refreshments, and padded couches lined the walls. "These will be your private chambers during recesses in the conclave," said Sanguinius.
"They are quite sufficient," replied Magnus.
Araman wanted to scream at the stilted formality of it all. Couldn't Magnus see that something was terribly wrong here? Sweat beaded on Araman's face and neck. He had the overwhelming urge to retreat to the waiting Stormhawk, fire up its engines, and fly back to the Fotip, never to return to Nykaia. A pair of bronze doors led into the heart of the mountain, and the future pressed in from the other side.
"Is there anything else you require, friend Azek?" asked Lord Commander Eidolon.
Araman shook his head, the effort of keeping his expression neutral almost beyond him. "No," he managed, "though I thank you for your concern." "Of course, brother," said Eidolon, and Araman caught the inflection on the last word. Sanguinius turned and nodded to Ralderon and Thoros, who took up position on either side of their master and threw the bronze doors open. It was all Araman could do not to scream a warning at Magnus. The Primarch of the Blood Angels marched through the great portal into the golden light with Fulgrim at his side. They beckoned Magnus to follow them. Magnus turned to face Araman, and he saw the hurt of impending betrayal in his eye.
"I know, Azek, I know," said Magnus wearily. "I see now why we are here."
Magnus turned and followed his brothers into the light. Araman followed Magnus through the doors, entering a grand amphitheatre hewn from the sharp-sided inner slopes of the volcano's crater. Thousands of figures filled its carved black benches, looking down into the amphitheatre. Most were robed adepts of high rank, though Araman saw groupings of Astartes scattered throughout the tiers. The stone floor of the amphitheatre was polished black marble, inlaid with a vast eagle of gold. Sanguinius and Fulgrim led them to the centre of the arena, and Araman was struck by the appropriateness of the term, reminded of old Romani legends that described how captured members of an underground sect had been thrown to the wolves and eaten alive for the perverse enjoyment of the crowd. Though the world around them was raging in its birthing pangs, the air within the volcano was utterly still. The tempest beyond its tapered peak kept at bay by the hidden workings of the Mechanicum. Araman's stride faltered as he saw the pyramid step dais at the opposite side of the amphitheatre and the being that awaited them. This was the epicenter of the light and the beacon that had guided them through the maelstrom of spatial interference around Nykaia. So bright that he was almost obscured by his own brilliance, the Emperor of Mankind sat upon a carved throne of soaring eagle's wings and grasping claws coloured with blood-red rubies. A golden sword lay across his lap, and he bore an eagle-topped orb in his left hand. Flags of black silk and gold embroidery rippled above the Emperor, borne aloft by silver cherubs with glittering clarions that filled the air with a tuneless fanfare. At once, Adaman was reminded of the Visconti Sforza card that Lemuel had asked him to catch.
"Judgment," he whispered,
wondering how he could have missed so obvious a portent. Custodes' warriors flanked their master and formed an armoured wall before the dais. Adaman's doubts fled in the face of so wondrous an individual. For what could trouble a mind so blessed with this vision of perfection before it? He could not see the Emperor's face, merely impressions. A thunderous brow and stern, patrician features cast in a mould of dashed hope.
"Clarity, Azek," said Magnus. "Stand with me and rise into the enumerations. Retain your keenness of thought."
Adaman tore his gaze from the Emperor with effort and stepped alongside Magnus. He whispered the names of the first masters of Tizca over and over until he achieved the peace of the lower sphere. Reaching that made advancing to the higher spheres easier, and Adaman's thoughts returned to something approaching equilibrium with every step he took. Freed from the clutter of emotion, he turned his attention to studying their surroundings as thoroughly as he might peruse any grimoire. He saw that the Emperor was not alone on the dais. The Praetorian beside the Emperor was a warrior Adaman had met once before on Terra, Constantine Valdor. From the look of the curling script that snaked all around his armour, Valdor had prospered in the ranks of the Custodes, his proximity to the Emperor surely marking him as its most senior member. A man in the plain dark robes of an administrator stood next to Valdor, an unassuming man, rendered fragile and insignificant next to the giant Custodes warrior. This man, too, Adaman recognised, his long mane of white hair and all too human frailties marking him out as Malkador the Sigillite, the Emperor's trusted right hand and most valued counsellor. To have earned a place in such rarefied company marked Malkador out as exceptional, even among a gathering of the most brilliant minds in the galaxy. He had not risen to such prominence by any virtue of eugenics, but by the simple brilliance of his mortal wisdom. A red-robed fusion of machine parts and organics was surely Kelbor Hal, the Fabricator General of Mars. But the others on the dais were unknown to him, except by reputation. The green-robed choir master of astropaths, the master of navigators, and the lord militant of the Imperial Army. The lowest tier of the amphitheatre was punctuated by cantilevered boxes, like those in a playhouse reserved for kings. A short flight of steps led from each box to the floor of the amphitheatre. Figures were sitting in the boxes, but Adaman couldn't focus on them or discern any traits of height, bulk, or appearance. Instead of defining forms, he saw shadows and reflections, each box filled with bent creases of light. Though there were unmistakably people within each box, technological artifice concealed them from sight. Falsehoods. Whoever occupied the boxes retained their anonymity by virtue of chameleonic cloaks that shielded them from the casual sight of observers. But Adaman was no casual observer, and not even the overwhelming light of the Emperor could completely obscure the titanic forces lurking beneath the falsehoods. Adaman turned his attention from the hidden viewers as Sanguinius and Fulgrim reached a raised plinth before the dais. Its only furniture was a simple wooden lectern, such as a conductor of an orchestra might use to rest his sheet music upon. Magnus and Adaman halted before the plinth, and the nine warriors of the Sekhmet stood sentinel with their masters. The Blood Angels and Emperor's children dropped to their knees before the Emperor, and the Thousand Sons followed suit. Adaman saw the dread of this moment in his dark eyes, reflected in the polished black floor.
"All hail the supreme master of mankind," said Sanguinius, his soft voice filling the amphitheatre with its quiet strength. "I present before you Magnus the Red, Primarch of the Thousand Suns and Lord of Prospero.
"Rise, my sons," said a voice that could only be the Emperor's.
Adaman had not seen him speak, but a reverent silence filled the amphitheatre, an utter absence of sound that seemed impossible with so many thousands gathered here. Adaman rose to his feet as Malkador the Sigillite descended the steps of the dais, bearing an eagle-topped scepter that Adaman recognized as belonging to the Emperor. It dwarfed the man, but Malkador appeared not to notice its bulk. Instead, he carried it as lightly as a walking cane. A pair of acolytes followed the Sigillite, one bearing rolled parchments, the other a smoking brazier in blackened iron tongs. Malkador crossed the gleaming floor of the amphitheatre and stood before the three primarchs. The Sigillite's white hair pooled around his shoulders like snowfall, and his skin was the texture of old parchment. He was just a man, yet had lived out the spans of many men. Some put this down to the finest and most subtle augmetics or a rigorous regime of juvenile treatment, but Adaman knew of no means that could sustain a mortal life for so long. Malkador had the wisdom of eons in his dark, deep-set eyes, wisdom won over the passage of centuries spent at the side of the greatest practitioner of the arts in the galaxy. That was how Malkador endured, not through cheap tricks or the artifice of technological trinkets, but by the Emperor's design. He held the staff up before Magnus, Fulgrim, and Sanguinius, and Adaman saw that his hands were thin, bony, and frail. How easy it would be to break them.
"Fulgrim, Magnus, Sanguinius," said Malkador, with what Adaman felt was woefully misplaced familiarity. "I'd like you all to place your right hand upon the staff, if you please."
All three Primarchs did so, sinking to their knees so their heads were level with Malkador's. The venerable sage smiled before continuing.
"Do you all swear that you shall do honour to your father? In sight of those assembled here on Nykaia, will you solemnly swear that you will speak the truth as it is known to you? Will you do glory to your legions and to your brothers by accepting the judgment this august body shall reach? Do you swear this upon the staff of the father who sired you, schooled you, and watches over you in this hour of upheaval and change?"
Adaman listened to the core of the Sigillite's words, seeing past the fine homilies and noble ideals to the truth beneath. This was no simple oath of the moment. This was an oath sworn by a defendant on trial for his life.
"Upon this staff, I swear it," intoned Fulgrim.
"By the blood in my veins, I swear it," said Sanguinius.
"I swear to uphold all that has been said upon this staff," said Magnus.
"Let it be so recorded," replied Malkador, with a stiff formality that went against his normally affable demeanour.
His acolytes stepped in towards the kneeling primarchs, the first unrolling a slender parchment with the words Malkador had said written upon them. He held it, pressed flat to Magnus's vambrace, while the second ladled a blob of hot wax from his brazier and poured it onto the parchment. This was then embossed with an iron stamp bearing the eagle and crossed lightning bolt seal of the Emperor. The servitors repeated this with Fulgrim and Sanguinius, and when they were done, they retreated behind Malkador.
"There," said the Sigillite, "now we can begin."
Hooded adepts led the Thousand Suns to the box on the lower tiers of the amphitheatre where they had entered. Magnus and his warriors took their places within the box as Fulgrim and Sanguinius were led to their seats. Excited conversations began once more. Adaman found himself drawn inexorably to the Emperor. High in the enumerations, he was freed from the impact of emotion and found he could see the master of mankind clearly, reading the reluctance etched into his regal features.
"He doesn't want this," said Adaman.
"No," agreed Magnus. "Others have clamoured for this, and the Emperor has no choice but to appease his supporters."
"Clamoured for what?" asked Adaman. "Do you know what is going on?"
"Not entirely," hedged Magnus. "As soon as I heard Fulgrim's voice, I knew something was amiss, but the heart of it eludes me."
As he spoke,
Magnus tapped his thigh, making a series of apparently innocuous movements with his fingers, as though he were loosening stiff joints. Adaman recognized him as the somatic gestures of the symbol of Thothmes, the means by which a sanctum could be made secure from observation. It was also a symbol for silence in the presence of the enemy. Beside the Primarch, Mahavastu Kallimachus faithfully recorded their words, his eyes fixed ahead without really seeing what was going on. Only a man completely under the sway of another could be so unaffected by the grand company assembled beneath the stars.
"In any case," said Magnus, "I believe we are about to learn the nature of this gathering."
Araman looked back to the floor of the amphitheater, seeing Malkador standing at the plinth with a sheaf of notes spread on the lectern before him. He cleared his throat, the acoustics of the volcano's crater amplifying the sound until even those ensconced at the back of the amphitheater could hear him clearly.
"My friends, we gather here on the birthing rock of Nykaea to speak on a subject that has vexed the Imperium since its inception. Many of you here today have come not knowing the substance of this conclave or the nature of this debate. Others know it all too well. For that, I apologize."
Malkador consulted his notes once more, squinting as though having trouble reading his own handwriting.
"And now to the heart of the matter," said Malkador. "This gathering will address the question of sorcery in the Imperium. Yes, gentlemen, we are here to resolve the librarian crisis."
A gasp of astonishment rippled from the tiers of the amphitheatre, though Adaman had guessed what the substance of Malkador's words would be as soon as he mounted the plinth.
"This is an issue that has divided us for many years, but here we will end that division. Some will maintain that sorcery is the greatest threat facing our dominion of the galaxy, while others will rail against what is said here, believing that fear and ignorance drives their accusers' hands. Let me assure you all, there is no greater crisis facing the Imperium, and the heroic undertaking upon which we are all embarked is too vital to risk with discord." Malkador drew himself up to his full height and said, "That being said, who among you shall speak first?"
A gruff voice cut through the chatter from the tiers.
"I shall speak," it said.
Undulant light in the box opposite the Thousand Suns rippled as a powerful figure threw off his falsehood. The warrior's beard was waxed, and he wore a snarling wolf's head across his shaved scalp. The skin of its forelegs was draped over his barrel chest, and its pelt formed a ragged cloak. Armoured in storm cloud grey, and bearing his eagle-headed staff across one shoulder, Othair Weirdmake, rune priest of the Space Wolves, stepped down into the amphitheatre.